Okay. Lepo pozdravljeni poslušalci in poslušalke Radija Študent. I will switch in English now because here with us is Michael Schmidt, anarchist historian, maybe, or what's the best definition of
him? Yeah, I guess so. That's, I realized by accident I've become sort of the global anorak on this story, sort of anarchist history, so... Yeah, you can call me that. That's fine. Although I'm not a trained historian.
Cool. Could you tell us, for a beginning, what's the very basic question? What's the definition of anarchism for you?
Well, this was an interesting starting point because. We didn't start out, myself and my co-author, who now lectures in sociology at one of the universities in South Africa, we didn't start out to write some books, etc., but I started rewriting a pamphlet and things got a little out of hand, and now it's two books. I think the main issue that we were presented with is that being in the global south, looking in at the global north and the way in which historically the anarchist movement was represented, we had to ask ourselves some basic questions around: did the anarchist movement, as it had been represented to us, have anything to say about our conditions in the south? And part of the problem was that there was this. The definitions were all over the place. So you even had pretensions at anarcho-fascism and all sorts of nonsense. So we needed a narrower, or at least a much clearer definition. But the definition had to come out of the historical record. So the two lines of inquiry, the historical line of inquiry and the ideological line of inquiry, had to talk to each other, and one had to inform the other. So we needed to talk about the real and existing anarchist movements and what that meant and what its principles were. And out of that, come up with a set of principles that were common. It would be impossible, for instance, I think, to extract, to take Marxist-Leninism out of the historical record and only talk about it theoretically. You have to talk about what Marxist-Leninists did in real life, including the gulags and contained forests and Kampuchea and all the rest, in order to locate it accurately. Okay, so that was a bit of a long introduction, but essentially we locate anarchism quite clearly within a progressive, rationalist, modernist, socialist movement, very distinctly revolutionary communist, grassroots communist, coming from, you know, socialism from below, not from above. It is against not just landlordism and the state, but specifically against capital and all the numerous and various forms of dispossession, deprivation and degradation that the elites tend to force on the majority. And this occurs at both a macro level in terms of things like imperialism and at a micro level, well, supposedly micro level, which in many respects is kind of larger, the intimate level of, let's say, interpersonal relations, gender, and this type of thing. So it has to be seen as a real cross-cutting critique of power imbalances and exploitative and destructive power balances, imbalances across human society. In its stead, it proposes a positive project. Anarchism is often seen as a negative project, but a positive project to build horizontally federated direct democracy and across large regions, which presupposes that anarchism is, in fact, does not spurn the concept of power in the sense of the ability to do things, but it spurns the traditional concept of power being a vertical structure that enables exploitation. So it's really about how the ability to achieve social goals is democratized and decentralized across large territories and very diverse communities, of course. Perhaps along, I came up at the university with a sort of a short t-shirt definition, if you will, to cut a long story short. Those who make the decisions are the same people as those who do the work are the same people who benefit from the work. With a little asterisk and in brackets saying, well, if you're unable to work, we will take care of you.
You said that you needed a historical approach, but I think the question comes to mind, where to begin with this history and what to include everything? You know, do we start with Stirner or do we start with Marx, Bakunin, or, I don't know, social movements of the 19th century?
It definitely was a point of concern. I think the most important thing, however, was to say, let's start at the point at which a movement that self-describes itself in this way arises. This is not to say necessarily that self-description automatically entails coherence. And today, of course, as I indicated at the beginning, you can see various movements that self-describe as anarchists that have nothing in common with each other. Especially, I'm sure, you know, between, let's say, maybe the anarcho-punk scene and the national anarchists or this type of thing, you're going to find very few points of convergence. You will find some, but of course you will find few. And probably a little bit more than both sides recognize, but the fact of the matter is that they are by no means the same thing. So we had to start with the movement that self-described as such by really starting to separate itself out, to distinguish itself from Marxian or Blanquist socialism, that sort of Putschist socialism, if you will, socialism from above, where it's about capturing the levers of power rather than redistributing power. And from there on, we worked through the historical record and we looked for differences and similarities, essentially. So we've wound up, to jump forward in time, with a definition that is controversial, because we include some movements that were self-described Marxist, but in their practices were conformed to what we define as the essences, the ethical essences, the practice and praxis of the anarchist movement. And there have been others which may have been self-described anarchist movements which we feel maybe don't tick all of the boxes and therefore kind of fall out. It's a controversial project in a way, because a lot of the feeling is that surely the nature of anarchism is to be undefinable. But it's a self-defeating project on the part of self-defined anarchists to say this, because this is what opens the doors to anarcho-capitalism, so-called anarcho-fascism, so-called national anarchism, so-called, etc. And I think we've got to be honest to say that a lot of the mythology that anarchists have built up around the movement has been counterproductive. And you can even go to people like Kropotkin and lay the blame there. We understand that when the movement arose, there was a necessity they felt to legitimize themselves and say, look, what we're doing is, it didn't fall from the sky. We're trying to stimulate natural human instincts towards freedom, etc. So then they started talking about Zeno and ancient Greece and all of these kind of precedents and claiming these as part of the movement. But we need to distinguish between maybe a libertarian ethic and the emergence of an anarchist movement. And quite clearly, the anarchist movement only emerges within the trade unions, which is a crucial point of the First International.
So, if I may, so where are these workers now that supposed to make this revolution happen? You know, you mentioned before that they are the, I suppose, anarcho-syndicalism is the, let's say, for you, right way how to change the society. So what is situation with this today and how is with other anarchisms like anarcho-communisms, like squatting scenes, social centers or social spaces scene, how they are related to this?
Without a doubt the nature of work has changed. But I think the sort of so-called post-anarchist or post-modernist critique that essentially says that the working class has disappeared is bullshit. I'm allowed to say that on radio, right? Student radio, of course, again, right? Because quite clearly, we still have class structures and we still have underclasses and laboring classes that provide the labor. The fact that labor is now flexibilized requires entirely different approaches from syndicalists. It's important to recognize that, however, that syndicalism was never purely an industrial strategy, that it never stopped at the factory gates. It was always fundamentally a social industrial strategy, that it that all these Ateneos, the night schools, the theatre groups, the rent strikes, the barrio assemblies, and all of these type of things, which we have started to see reemerge in places like Argentina from 2001, etc., or in the Zapatista struggles and this type of thing. You know, these are struggles of the class that labor. They don't necessarily have to be impressed into some giant Fordist production line type factory for the same basic social industrial ethic to apply. Tactically, of course, things do have to change because the environment is very different. But the fundamentals of exploitation, in many respects, have gotten deeper because the state and the parasitic capitalist elites have developed new and much more intrusive techniques for penetrating the class. Not least of which is popular culture, as we know. And I think one of the crucial things that the anarchist movement historically provided and still does today is counterculture. Counterculture, and this is not necessarily about having a nose ring or green hair, although I've done all of the above, is really about establishing a cultural environment that is in breach with bourgeois ethics, and that therefore creates an enabling environment for the creation of proletarian counterpower. In other words, it's a seedbed for structures to challenge the control of everyday working lives to take place. So I think there always were narrow syndicalists. We know this both today and previously. But I think syndicalism generally, as a broad movement historically, would really be mischaracterized if it was seen purely as industrial. It was always industrial and social. It always extended beyond the factory gates. Syndicalists built the first black colored Indian trade unions in South Africa and the first trade unions in China, and these were crucial steps. But if they didn't at the same time build the first universities in places like Egypt, Peru, China, etc.,
then, you know, popular universities in particular, if they weren't engaged socially and intellectually and creatively and artistically, then I think the movement would have been a whole lot poorer and probably wouldn't have achieved the levels of success that it did, particularly throughout Latin America and in other parts of the world. Now, what you're talking about is a movement that operates according to anarchist principle, but is in fact a pluralistic movement. So it operates according to libertarian socialist principle, but includes everybody. Probably a bulk of people who are non-politically aligned, a whole bunch of left social revolutionaries, dissident Bolsheviks, anarchists and others, S.A. Maximus, etc. And I think that's important because, you know, I dispute that anarchists are or should be trying to build an anarchist world. Anarchists should be trying to build a free world. In which even people who've grown up in a conservative ethic are liberated from the constraints of conservatism. And yeah, maybe they're going to be quiet and not very revolutionary or whatever, and their lifestyle is all going to be about their quality of their home life and their family and this type of thing. But in which they are equally at liberty to be who they are naturally, without, of course, impinging on the freedom of others. So I think looking for some sort of purism is in movements, in social movements, is foolish. I think what we need to be stimulating rather than ideological purism or adherence to a particular political line, including the anarchist one or ones, plural, is an adherence, a libertarian practice, libertarian socialist practice.
Maybe in this context, what you just said about that anarchists shouldn't try to make anarchistic world, and that they shouldn't be so pure and so on. I have, for example, I think a little bit concrete question. Tomorrow, I think, here are in Europe, European, how to say it, elections. And you have many new, how to say, anti-capitalistic parties, which have on the ideological level, on the level of content, pretty the same speech that you said before about labor, classes, against neoliberalism, and so on. But with that little difference that they are trying to do this, how to say it, from above. But they have also this that things shouldn't be done only for above. We are only the party, but we need you, we need the movement, and so on. And the question simply would be, how should from the certain anarchistic position, how should we react towards those parties?
I have a pamphlet that I picked up from one of their stalls down here. This United Left, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the main question is, again, around power. Working class in the organized working class in Spain clearly had a majority on the streets. Why on earth the anarchists agreed to equal representation with marginal parties in representative forums is a hard question. It's the same thing in South Africa. There are these good comrades, good people. Some of them are Trotskyists, some of them are dissidents who've left the Communist Party because of lack of internal democracy. But they are still wedded to this party route. And apart from anything else, the pragmatic thing is to say, well, we're going to surrender the realm in which we are powerful, where we have a majority, which is on the street, and we're going to become a minority
in a hostile environment. Why would you do that? And you have to pay to do that in the first place, because you've got to pay a deposit that if you don't get the seats, you will lose as well. So it's hugely expensive for poor movements to try and get themselves into parliamentary structures or even local government structures, etc. It's very expensive for them to do this. And they know that when they get in there, they're going to be minorities. In other words, they're always going to be outvoted. And it's a huge diversion of struggle. And that's the main political problem, is that not only does it then endorse the exploitative structure, but it also completely creates a system of, or an ethic amongst the working class of dependency and of inactivity. That we will wait to see what comes out of Parliament before we move. And only if things really don't go our way and it's extremely bad, then we'll march. Whereas, particularly in South Africa, people know at least that they've come from, we have something like 300,000 protests annually. About 30 of them are violent. Now, but violent for us means people get killed, okay, not a bus stop gets burnt down. We've in the last year, we've burnt down 65 million rands worth of municipal equipment in protests. Yeah, we know how to protest. And even that doesn't move much, because the state has shown that it's prepared to send in police with military armaments to massacre people. So how do you resist? You know, do you resist? Can you resist through parliamentary structures? Can you change things through parliamentary structures as a minority? Even if you became the majority, how much of your time, energy, resources, just your human strength goes into this, what is essentially, it has to be the graveyard of democracy. When even fighting on the streets doesn't necessarily get you what you want, because there needs to be more. It needs to go beyond the individual movements, it needs to become a broad social consensus, and it needs to have a plurality of forces, but it needs to be able to achieve a critical mass within a society, but a critical mass with a vision. Because we've seen in Egypt what happens when you have a critical mass without a vision.
Okay, maybe related to what you just said, usually people which are objecting anarchism or this method, non-hierarchical, out-of-parliament organization, they said, yeah, it's nice, but you cannot do anything that way, because you have to use institutions of power if you want to change that power. And for example, during your lecture on Thursday, you many times said the word anarchistic government, and also you have gave many examples of those anarchistic societies which has established through the history for a certain amount of time. And how is it possible to achieve this goal? How not just to protest against something, but how to build a community which has its own government that is non-hierarchical, or maybe even on a concrete example, how does it look like?
Well, this is a crucial question, and obviously this is what the Marxists usually come at us with and say, well, surely you have to use the existing levers of power. I mean, you can transform them, etc., but you need that. You need that power structure, you need that vehicle of the state in order to transform the society towards socialism. Of course, the anarchist argument is different and says that, well, surely if we're talking about the attainment of democracy, then power should really reside with the people. And power, in fact, does reside with the people. And this is the question, well, balance of forces. Where does power really reside in your country? Power resides, there's the moment in Alice in Wonderland where she's about to be executed by the orders of the Red Queen. And then it suddenly dawns on her that, well, you're all just a pack of cards, and everything just comes falling down. So power is ascribed to certain ideas. The state has power because people believe in the state. I stopped fearing the South African Defence Force in the apartheid era when I decided to become a military objector. But I'd already been through 2 years in the army, and it was only really at the point where I lost the fear that they lost the power. Okay, they no longer had power over me the moment I realized how fake the whole thing was. The question is, where does power reside? Well, power resides in human belief and the structures to which people ascribe power. So clearly the task of the anarchists or libertarian socialists more broadly is to create horizontal, federated, directly democratic counterpower structures that will gain the confidence of people. And you can only do this through work that is not sectarian, not narrowly boxed, not restricted to single sectors, that is really pluralistic and diverse. And it takes a long time. I mean, they say I'm a journalist, and they say in journalism, and I'm sure it applies to other paths as well, so tell no lies and claim no easy victories. Well, you know, I've been working at this for 25 years in South Africa. Probably our greatest success, if you want, is that, you know, we now have a cadre of, you know, predominantly black young militants who understand anarchism. You can't necessarily create the historic conditions that will precipitate a collapse of the bourgeoisie. This notion, I think, it's a bit of a dangerous notion. When the crisis point arrives, who knows? Sometimes it's too early. In Egypt's case, it may well have been too early, because, as I say, there was a lack of not a lack of vision, but a lack of a collectively agreed vision about what happens afterwards and what do we do with the military. They avoided that question largely. And it came back to bite them. So, but in terms of, you know, I wouldn't use the term anarchist government per se. I'd use maybe anarchist administration, because we're talking about the administration of things and not the governance of people. But there are at least four historic examples that have sufficient sustainability to say, well, this is anarchism in practice. So how did that work? How did they feed people? How did they protect it in conditions of continually shifting warfare? You know, these are important questions, because these things did happen. And one of the most important things is the social aspect. And the anarchist movement really has to be a social movement, and, as I say, a truly counter-cultural movement before it can establish a proletarian counterpower.
Interview Radia Student.